Well, we're here, guys. This is Talking Luft. And if you've heard the last one, we've come up with a new idea. This is Roubaix's most influential top six. It's an idea we did with San Remo, and I'm back here with again this idea because Roubaix was on the weekend, and I just love this race and I love talking about it. This is, of course, Life in the Peloton. I'm Mitch Stocker, and the podcast is made possible by our major partner, MAP. I love working with these guys, especially because the company is born right out of my hometown, Melbourne. If you didn't hear that episode, San Remo's top six, go back and have a listen. That was just about a month ago. To get the idea of what this episode is about, we're just discussing what makes this race so great for me. Who are those people? Who are those teams? What are those segments? What are the most influential factors of Paris-Roubaix that I love? But of course, I've got a guest on here to discuss it with me, none other than the legend himself, Matt Goss. The guy who rode Roubaix, I got to race with him. I grew up racing with him as a junior, and then we became teammates overseas in Green Edge as well. It's a bit of a laugh, this episode. If you heard it last time, it's a bit of a back and forth, just discussing who thinks what ideas we've got. And I got a lot of feedback from the last episode about, I don't agree with that. This is better. This ride is better. But that's what it's about. It's my opinion, and you guys get to sit back and listen to it. Now, the podcast is also being made possible by our other sponsor, Pillar. Now, I challenge you guys to get out there and give this a go. I seriously challenge you to give it a go because this is something that I really love using. A little bit of background about Pillar. Pillar is a sports micronutrition company coming out of Australia. They're developing products that intersect between pharmaceutical intervention and sports supplements for athletes. What the hell does that mean? You're probably thinking to yourself, well, it's not electrolytes, it's not carbohydrates. They're the things that we use when we're out exercising. They're the things that get us to the finish line. Pillar's mission is to get us and athletes to the start line or waking up every day in our best condition over and over again. The way they do that is they use triple magnesium. This is a product that makes you sleep so well. Magnesium is known to aid your sleep. With Pillar's triple magnesium, you drop into an amazing deep sleep. I don't wear sleep devices, so I'm not measuring that stuff. But if you do wear a sleep device, you can guarantee you're going to see a change in your sleep score. The way I notice it is I drop into a seriously deep slumber. My wife can't even wake me up. She's got to shake me to wake me up. In the morning, when I wake up, I feel like I've woken up from a deep sleep. But immediately, what I do notice is I feel really refreshed. It does make me feel much more recovered. The times that I'm not taking the triple magnesium is when I notice I don't sleep quite as good. What I like to do is to take it about 30 minutes before bed each night. If you want to try Pillar today, head across to pillarperformance.shop and use the code LITP for 15% off your first order, or for USA listeners, head across to thefeed.com/pillar. Give it a shot, guys. Get 15% off. Try it out. Let me know what you think. You know what? If you don't like it, you don't have to use it again, but give it a shot at least one time and tell me you don't sleep better. Guys, sit back and enjoy this one. Roubaix was on the weekend, so we're still in the aftermath, but we can still embrace the beautifulness of this race. Here we go. Talking Luft, top six, Roubaix. All right, here we go. This is Paris-Roubaix, Talking Luft, Paris-Roubaix, top six most influential. I'm joined by a very special guest, Gossie, Matt Goss. Mate, welcome. This is a special one.
Thanks, mate. This is going to be a bit of fun. Talk about, you know, what's happened on the weekend and a few years before that, eh?
Well, let's start with the weekend, shall we? Pretty interesting race. We don't have to recap the whole race. That's not really what we're doing here unless, well, actually, before we get into that, maybe I should explain what this series is. You're new to it. The listeners out there are pretty new to it. The idea of this is I'm just going to pick out some races or some points in the season. It could be a grand tour. It could be a single race where, I don't know, I just thought it'd be interesting breaking down the top five most influential people from that race, or people or things. It could be sectors. It could be teams. It could be people. It could be winners. And just sort of discuss them, for me anyway, who they are for me, why I love that race, why they're most so influential to me. And then I've thrown a cheeky one in there. The sort of, you got your non-questionable, and then you've got your questionable. Just that roughy. You know, you go, I'm not too sure about this one. I just want to throw an extra one in the mix. So that's sort of the theory that I've come up with. I don't know, Gussie, were you able to put sort of 5-6 together in your head?
Yeah, mate, I think I've chucked a few together. The one you just said before, which is quite interesting, is sectors. You know, I didn't really think about that. But, you know, you look at this race and everyone knows Arenberg Forest. Everyone, there's a few sectors everyone knows, but they're pretty decisive in the race.
We should have done a sector. I didn't even think about it. I thought about it just then. I should just throw a sector in. Damn.
We can chuck in a sector each. It's not hard. Let's do it.
Yeah, well, let's just do 7 then. Let's just chuck a sector in. Well, let's talk about last night. Well, the night before. It is Tuesday, 2 nights ago for us, or 2 days ago. The Roubaix this year, mate. What did you think of the race?
I think it's just like every race I've seen this year. You know, it's just so fast, so hard, from so early on. You know, watching that race on Sunday night, it's unbelievable. Normally you have a big field, you know, say 70% of the field, 75% of the field come into Arenberg. And that was already decimated before then. You know, that used to be where, not the race started, but that's where the race started. And we were already down to probably 50 guys by that point. It was already blown apart. And a lot of people's day was done before it even got started.
It was exactly that. And I want to say, arguably for me, it was so impressive what Vanderpool did that I got to a point where I'm like, I sort of know the result, 50K to go. Started falling asleep back here in Australia. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe this. It's so great what he's doing. Yet, I don't want to use the word boring, but I wish there was a bit more action.
Well, mate, you look at it, there's absolutely no taking away from what he's done. It's so impressive to ride off the front. And I was the same as you. I watched that move, start to get the gap open. I'm like, well, we kind of know what's going to happen here, but that's a very spectatory thing to say. If you were that bike rider and you were that strong, mate, it's the best 60Ks of your life, isn't it? Like, but for us, like, yeah, it's like when you finish racing. You know, I want to watch mount stage now, not a sprint stage. Oh, they're boring, but give me that time in the peloton, not a chance. Give me a sprint there every other week. But, you know, it was a bit like that. But I think we had so much action from the get-go until that point too. So, you know, what else can we expect from these guys? They're just riding full gas. It's just impressive.
What's your one takeaway point from Roubaix this year?
One takeaway point? I can't really think of one point, actually. It's interesting that chucked a chicane in before Arenberg. That's a point to look at. Just because, for me, that was one of the scariest parts of the race. And big adrenaline rush, you know. You've had some misfortunes through there. And when you go in there, it's just so unknown. Like, you know you're going in. It's like a bunch sprint. So that's a big change in the race. So, look, it's a takeaway that I guess they're trying to do everything they can to make these races safer. And we still got an amazing show. And I can only imagine how hard Arenberg is if you go in after going through a chicane, because you lose all your speed through half of that and the last half drags back uphill, which is solid. So if you're coming in 40K an hour instead of 65, mate, that makes that first half just as difficult as well. So maybe, you know, it's just something to look at from the race in terms of it's still got a spectacle. It's definitely different. It's something for older than us guys that race years ago to look at and go, what are they changing all these original features? But it doesn't change the race.
I reckon my takeaway point is the same point, but I'm sort of like, and I guess I'm in the position to say it because I have crashed on there. Leave it as it is. Let it be as it'll be. And, you know, I love that. If we're going to change it, why don't we race it from the other way? I'm saying we. Why don't they race it from the other way? You know, the way they used to turn right into it. Or find another street.
That's basically a U-turn into that point anyway, if you're coming in the opposite way. For me, that Arenberg, it's one of my – I've seen that, but for me, my first time doing that race, I remember we did recon with CSC or Saxo. I can't remember what it was, but my first time. It must have been Saxo. And I went into Arenberg in training, and I got out the other side, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to tell the team I can't do this. Like, I went through that 40K an hour, and I could barely hold it up. I'm like, how am I going to go in there at the race? And then and I was like, just – toughen up, mate. Like, you can't just pull the pin because it's too hard to go through there. We got to race day, and I remember actually coming in the front, the top 10 guys there, and I looked down at the speed, and we're doing like 67K an hour, and I just remember thinking, I was crapping myself at 40. So I was just like, hold on. So that's like one of my first memories of Roubaix as well. So I kind of, you know, like you, I'd like to see it still stay the same, because that tradition, and that's one of my first memories of that race, but that real specific one that sticks in your mind. And I was like, this is going to be an embarrassing conversation to help Bjarne Riis that, you know, maybe send me to Catalonia.
Oh, well, in case you didn't know what the hell we're talking about, Hell of the North, Queen of the Classics, the Easter race, Sunday in Hell, Roubaix, I guess a little bit of history on it. The first edition was 128 years ago. It's one of the oldest races in the world, 1896. And the two guys, the way the race started, I don't know if you knew this, Cossie, the two guys who built the track in Roubaix went, how cool would it be to hold a race that finishes on our velodrome? So they contacted the guy who was organizing the race, Bordeaux Paris, and said, hey, a couple of weeks before, do you want to hold like a bit of a warm-up race? But we go Paris to Roubaix, and we finish on this velodrome that we've just built. You know, you organize it for us and we'll run it. And then, you know, the first edition, they did it, and the guys who finished said, this is hell. We're never doing this again. This is a stupid idea. A few too many cold ones that night. And forgot all about it, typically, and went, yeah, you know what, I'll do that the next year. And so the rest is sort of history. I sort of like that little bit of history about the race. And in case you didn't know also about Gossie's history, the way we're going to do it, and I'll use you as an example, Gossie, for the way we're going to do it today. A little bit about you. You were 10 years in the Peloton. You retired in 2016. You rode on teams like CSC, Saxo Bank, HCC, Green Edge, MTN, and One Pro Cycling. You're a two-time winner of the Giro, winner of Milan-San Remo. But when it comes to Roubaix, mate, disappointingly, you started the race only four times. Couldn't believe that. I thought you rode it a few more times.
No, mate, the biggest issue was that the team always, especially at Green Edge, they were a lot more focused on the Tour de France and the green jersey and the sprint stages. So I kind of did the early classics, Tirreno, Milan-San Remo. And then I got taken out of the classics for a few years just to focus on the green jersey and the sprints at the Tour de France. So that happened a bit. And then also my first year pro, I was in a team with Fabian and Stewie and those guys. So breaking into that team was a bit tough as a Neo pro. So I would have liked to have done it a few more times, absolutely. But it was more a team decision to focus on the sprints later in the year. You know, I think most of the time, actually, I end up going to the Giro and race 2 weeks of the Giro just to prep for the Tour. So that kind of eliminated the Roubaix, and which is, it's kind of crappy because it's a race I love, but you know, we had priorities at the time and that's where they laid. My best chance would have been after San Remo in 2011, where I was still going really well. And I come into Arenberg and broke my chain. So I had to sit on the side of the road for you know what it's like when you go through there, there's carnage, you stop. By the time you get a team car, you know, and when you're chasing guys like Fabian and Boonen in their prime, you know, I had to have everything go right. And when you break a chain there, it's kind of game over. I chased for about okay, and you know, and got back to the front. So it's one of those races that it always just has something go your way. I think even in 2010, I was in the front group of 20 guys and I punched on that Marc Madiot sector. And then again, I had to wait 2 minutes. And then for someone like myself, I just can't get back to guys like Boonen, Cancellara, Pizzato, Hushov, those guys, you know, big, powerful dudes, that you know, everything had to be perfect for me. And if one hiccup, it was game over. And, you know, that's that race. That's why it's so special too.
I like looping myself in with you, and I can only gingerly do that. But I used to say the same thing, that I'm a guy who can afford no mistakes. Those big guys, I can have one or two, when I say mechanicals or mistakes or whatever, they can come back from that. But I needed the luckiest day ever. Beautiful dry run, nothing, everything going my way. And maybe I had a chance at running like a top 15. That was sort of how
it's funny. Like, we probably won't even get off this topic at this rate, mate. But the funniest, my most interesting result there, I think, was in 2009, the first time I did the race. We came into the velodrome and we were minutes behind. I think, I can't remember who won that year actually. It was no doubt Boonen or somebody, but they were like 4 or 5 minutes up the road, but we were still racing for 10th place. And there was about a group of 20 of us. And me being the only guy who spent probably 10 years of my career on the track, come to the velodrome and I thought, you beauty, I've got these guys stitched up. I thought I'll just lay back here a little bit. And like when you sprint at the end of 250Ks after being on the clock, like sprinting on the track, man, I got stuck on the hip. I was like 10 wide and I think I finished 20th out of the 25 guys in that. So instead of running 9th or 10th, I think I run about 33rd. And I'm like, I crossed the line. I'm like, you're the only guy that's raced on the track in years and you've absolutely botched it. So it was hilarious.
All right, well, we're going to get into the guys who are actually good at this race, you know, rather than just sort of talk about our sob stories, because I reckon the way we should do it, I want to talk about each other person, but I reckon it's nice to sort of give it a bit of context, and I'll use you again for an example. So we'll run through, in your first edition, you finished 32nd. pretty decent. We just heard that story then. You started four, you finished two, your lowest finish was out of time, so sort of whatever that position is, and your highest result, as we said, was 32nd in your first race. Mate, that's you. You're not one of my six, unfortunately. You want to kick us off? Have you? We haven't discussed this. We're going to sort of just run through and see what we've got, if there's double ups, whatever. Who makes your top five, Gossie?
Look, I guess being an Aussie and being on the same team, Stewie's got to be one of the most influential, because that was my first year pro racing in the same team. I was actually in a different race.
This man has handled them better than anybody else. Stuart O'Grady now, to me, is finding his third or fourth win. He knows he's won the race. He's beginning to enjoy it.
You know, sitting there with your teammates in a room watching a teammate win, and, you know, a good mate, an Aussie as well. So that's pretty much my first one to kick off with. Well, I think he started 14 times, you know, and like most guys in that race, if you've done that race more than a handful of times, you know, your best result's your best result, whatever that may be. But I think nearly everyone's going to have a DNF outside the time limit. So, you know, I think his best was a win, and like, probably very early on and outside time limit. But at least it only takes one small thing that can really hamper your day.
I remember that year. He was in the break. It was a really hot addition as well. Vesserman, he was up there as well. And
there must have been like 20-plus guys in there, which, again, you just don't see that these days. It doesn't seem there's too much.
First Australian winner as well.
Yeah, which is amazing, isn't it? Like, I guess historically, you know, Australia has produced more sprinters. And, you know, you go back further, you've got your Phil Andersons, more climbers, these type of guys. But, you know, it's not really a race that you're – before Stewie would associate, and Matt Hayman would associate too many guys with, you know. There's been two guys had good results there, but to pull that one off is pretty mega.
What did it do for you though? Like, was it like, oh yeah, right, I'm up for Roubaix now? Like, did that give you sort of the bit more enthusiasm for the race? Because I reckon when I saw Grady win that, I was already connected to the race for the toughness, but I think I actually didn't know how good O'Grady was in Roubaix. You know, it sort of just slips your mind before you actually become a pro. You're like, oh, yeah, unless they win it, you're like, oh, they mustn't be very good. Then all of a sudden you get over there, you're like, holy hell, they finished like top 20 like about five, six times. That's so good.
Within a shot of the lead is a massive effort. And I guess that maybe that's why my results show that. Like, you go in blind, you think, oh, I've seen these people do well here. Like, let's go. And then you do the first one, you're like, I'm out of my depth. Like, so, you know, you see these guys, especially, you know, we'll probably talk about others later, or we will talk about others later on, but, you know, to really be in that race and see how impressive it is for those guys to win is, it's a different kettle of fish, that race.
All right, I'm going to follow in suit. Australian, second Australian to win. It was not obvious. Matty Hayman, 2016.
Come up towards the line now. Matthew Hayman is finding the sprint of his life, and he's won it. I don't believe it. Australia will go berserk. Matthew Hayman has won Paris-Roubaix, only the second Australian ever. Unbelievable.
Look, I'm not going to repeat the story. Everyone knows the story of Hayman. I was there in that edition as well. I had a crash, as we all know, so I'm not going to go through all that, but the thing with Hayman is his first edition, he finishes 22nd. 17 starts, 17 finishes. His lowest finish was out of time. Pretty amazing that he got through all 17 without having a problem. That's pretty rare. He won on his 15th attempt. You think he would have given up by then, Gossie?
That's persistence, isn't it? You know, and like you said, everyone knows the story of it, but to do it the way he did is impressive. And to start that race 17 times alone is a massive achievement anyway. To be in the peloton and racing that race for that long is huge. And to have only one time outside time limit, like you said, a puncher can send you outside the time limit at the wrong time. So, you know, he's absolutely, you know, deserving of the result he got. And, you know, hats off to him for sticking at it that long to achieve it.
I think it gave me the hope, like with Hayman, and there's been numerous other people like him where, and this is, again, no disrespect to Hayman, it's like it's that sort of second-tier rider, that guy that, you know, you don't expect sort of to win a race like Roubaix. That sort of makes me think, like, I could maybe win Roubaix one day. You know, not that I'm as good as Hayman, but it's like it gives a lot of riders hope that, you know, like a race like Flanders sort of feels like, you just got to be a freak to win that. Like, ultimately, you're going to come to the Koppenberg and you're just like, well, you know, there's like five guys that can race up this. Whereas Roubaix, I don't know, it's just something about the mix. There's such a chance for punches and crashes and things like that, that it is really anyone's race.
You know, I think that the racing has changed now for sure. And I think especially 10, 15 years ago, when they'd let a big group of 15, 20 guys go, you know, you get up the road and you've given yourself a real opportunity. You know, you've still got to finish it off, don't get me wrong. But there was always a race in two races there. The first one was for the breakaway to get in that. If you thought you had any chance of winning, but you couldn't keep up with Cancellara, Boonen, Hushov, Pizzardo, those guys. Get in the break. You try and have an easy ride for 150 or 180K. I hope they catch you with 30K to go or 50K to go and hang on as best you could and hope you've saved enough gas. Well, you look at it now, it's just a polar opposite. There's half the field gone by the time you're 150K in. And, like, you know, there's a bunch of seven guys up the road that have absolutely rode balls to the wall for that far. And when they're caught, they're more tired than the guys behind.
Well, the break this year was pointless. Yeah.
No, it was completely pointless. You know, remember the days when I used to try and get in the break? You know, it was literally that. You would put everything on the line for 50K just to have an easier ride. You know, you're not fighting into every sector. You're just riding across them at tempo, you know. But now it's just, I think there was probably guys absolutely spent before the race even started, you know. So it's different the way it's changed. And, you know, I think there is only a handful of guys that you go to the start of that race and go, you know, these five guys are going to be there. But again, like I said, there's been winners over the years, which you probably wouldn't have picked as well. You know, you look at Ben Sumner and like some of these guys that you wouldn't think before you went into the race, he's going to be the one that stand on the top step today.
Do you think that takes something away from the race or adds to it for you?
I think it's got to add to it, you know. Like if you're on a good day and everything goes your way and you can beat the best guys in the world in one of the hardest races in the world, you're a deserving winner. It's an age-old thing. It's one of the easiest classic to finish, but one of the hardest ones to win. And everyone can win it. So it's kind of a similar situation that, you know, maybe not everyone can win Roubaix, but, you know, there's always...
Not everyone can finish it either.
So I think it's interesting, you know, I don't think anyone that can win one of these monuments of the sport, you know, especially these cobbled classics, they have to be the best, one of the best bike riders in the world. So, you know, I enjoy it.
All right, hit me with a who's your next one then. Do you have Heyman on your list? Heyman not make your list?
Yeah, I think he did.
We've ticked Heyman off, have we? So Heyman's what, your number two? Two Aussies.
Yeah, well, we've rolled into the other Aussie. Yeah. So Heyman was on my list.
Right.
But we're not doing them in any specific order, are we? So
no specific order, I don't reckon, unless you want to.
Let's mix it up. I think you can't have a list without Boonen.
Tom Boonen, a little bit of track skill here. He's going to go early. He's over the top of Cancellara. He's over the top of Alessandro Milan. He wins Paris-Roubaix for a second time. And where does he get the power from? Big Tom is an absolute superstar. He salutes the crowd and he's shown the Belgian press he really is the best.
Ah, oh, nice. Uh-huh. Of course you're going to have it.
Yeah.
Right, well, I've doubled up on that one too. Right, give me your theory then. Why does he make your list?
Well, what's he won it four times? Yeah. You can't discount a dude who's won the race four times. Like, we're just sitting here saying how hard it is to finish it. Imagine to win it four times. But it's also, again, it's an era that I was actually racing in at that time. Yeah. So it's a bit more relatable. You know, we talked about how hard it is when you're watching it as a young, or how it looked hard, but when you actually did it as a rider, it's a different kettle of fish. And then to race it with these guys who, you know, win it four times is just unbelievable. And, you know, what was his first ever Roubaix? It was in 2005 or four or something, wasn't it, with US Postal and finishing third in your first attempt, you know, like...
2002, exactly. His first attempt, he finishes third.
Mate, that's just unbelievable. You know, like you sit here and talk about someone like Heyman, you know, races, what, 15, 16 editions before getting the W, and to come away on the podium in your first crack at a race just, you know, shows the caliber.
He started 14 editions, finished 13, lowest finish ever, 24th position. That's nuts. I can't believe that. In 13 finishes, his lowest edition is 24th. If I could finish 24th, like, you, that's just like, hang your hat up. Like, top 30 of Roubaix is like pretty solid. Everyone's gone, mate, great ride of Roubaix last week. Jeez, you're on a good one this year. Like, that's his worst result.
Yeah, mate, it's just, like I said, it's just a different kettle of fish. And also, I think the rivalry, you know, a couple of other guys you're going to, you know, it wasn't as though there was no one around at that period. You know, he was racing guys that have also won it two or three times, and, you know, guys have been on the podium multiple times.
But it's just there's that handful of dudes that went through that era of cycling that were built for that race, as well as many other parts of the sport as well. But, you know, to see the rivalry between, you know, him and Fabian and these guys through that period was, you know, it was pretty cool to be part of, whether, you know, part of in the sense that we were racing at the same time, but, you know, not in the same.
Yeah. Yeah, we're on the start line. Let's say that.
I was early on that day.
I was chatting to Tom Boonen the other week. We had him on the pod and we were referencing some races and things like that. And I was sort of talking like, yeah, you know, I was in that race too. But I was like, yeah, I was at the bottom of the Tyenberg. Like when you're at the top of the Tyenberg, like, and he was the reason why I was getting dropped.
Yeah.
I had no effect on his race whatsoever.
He inflicted a lot of pain. Remember the Tyenberg? Every time you see him attack or tuck up the edge of the road, you're like, oh my God, now my day's ruined. And also, you know, I think it just shows gives, I don't want to say credibility, that's the wrong word, but it just makes Heyman's result look that much more powerful, that much stronger.
Mm.
You know, the fact that he pumped him in the velodrome.
And not only that, when he attacked him at like 2K to go, I loved that. That bit for me in the Heyman result was the best. When Boonen goes, I was like, oh, there he goes. They're finally, the string's broken on that little uphill before they hit the last sector.
Yep.
Heyman, when I saw Heyman going across to him, I was like, oh, I can't believe Heyman's even getting across. This is amazing. He's got to his wheel. Then he just hits him again. I'm like, what? How can you even do that, Heyman? Who are you? And then when he just pumps him in the sprint, I was just like,
yeah, well, when he comes back together, I was like, oh no, Heyman spent his bickies now. And then still just to roll around and win the sprint. You know, that's, like, I'll try and win it solo. If that doesn't work, I'll do it in the sprint.
And leads it out.
Yeah.
From half a lap out.
This shows, like what I said before, man, like sprinting at the end of that race is just different to any other race. Like, you get out of your seat and you go, yep, stomp on the pedals. And you go, nah, sit back down and just hang on as best you can.
Well, speaking about Boonen, he actually wins in his fourth edition of Roubaix. He gets a victory. He was third, 24th, 9th, and then wins one. Second the next year, 6th, wins it the next year, wins it the following year. It just goes on. He's got the record with Roger De Vlaeminck. Four times, I reckon it could possibly get broken by Vanderpoel if he goes on with it.
Mate, if you look at the dominance that, you know, especially this year, I think that it is a real chance. But again, like we said, it only takes one or two small things to, you know, turn your day around. But I guess if you can ride that far off the front by yourself, if you puncture, that's not really the end of the world either. So, you know, I think realistically, yeah, I think we could see it broken. And, you know, that's what they're there for, aren't they, records? So, well, you look at the world average speeds of the races this year. Like, I think Roubaix was the record, Flanders was the record, and Milan-San Remo were both the fastest ever editions. So, you know, these guys are
all tailwinds, wasn't it? All tailwinds, that's why.
Yeah, it must have been. We had got more pressure or something than tyres. We just sound like those old dudes, you know, like they're not using dry chip shifters.
All right, well, so you've gone Stewie, Boonen, I've gone Heyman, Boonen. We're two up each. Do you want to take – you started up with Boonen. Do you want me to do the next one?
You go the next one, mate.
Well, I've gone a bit of a different angle here. Is a guy that I absolutely love to watch, but I feel like was the rider that should have had one, if not two, Roubaix. I'm talking about George Hincapie.
Second place, George. You had to be very pleased with that.
Yeah, I'm pleased with second. Just going to make me dream for the win more next year.
All right. Good job and
thanks,
good luck.
From the same era, he just came through a really tough era where he was against, you know, the Mapei squad coming through. Then he had Boonen, Cancellara. He was always just there. He rode first edition, he finished 31st. He started 16 editions. He finished 15th. His lowest was out of time. His highest result was second. He had that massive crash in 2006 where he broke his head tube steerer and just sort of wobbled off the side when he was running for Postal. But like he was fourth a couple of times, sixth, eighth, second. Just Georgie, he should have got it. And he was inspiring for me because, again, he was that guy who in a team that didn't, well, not that I really know this, but I never felt like they had the focus on the classics. It was always obviously about the tour. But he still carved his own way with the classics without a massive squad around him and made it happen.
Yeah, agreed, mate. He's one of mine too. And you know, I just remember that crash. I can't remember the sector. I know you come down the hill, turn left, it kind of goes through a little dip and up, and it was always seemed to be wet in there. But I remember, yeah, that year he broke the steerer. And again, just one of those guys was persistent. You know, it was just one of those things that he seemed so driven to achieve. And, you know, it was painful sometimes to see him finish those seconds and thirds. But like you said, you know, you're up against an era of guys that were super strong in it. And I agree 100% saying that, you know, they're all Postal's focused on the tour. I wasn't in the team, but, you know, it's like watching, you know, teams of the past that were focused on just the Tour de France. You know, this is just a fill-in race for the other guys. So, you know, he might have had two or three guys there with him that realistically wanted to be there and wanted to help.
And he was a freak at it. Like, he just the way he had to go about it, and he sort of inspired me, especially in those ones where he's just one out, just covering stuff, especially that year he talks about it. Actually, I had him on the pod as well, and he was talking about it when Carnarvon won. And he's like, yep, you know what? That day I had the chance to choose who won. And surveys, you still owe me a few drinks, mate, because I gave you that victory at Roubaix. He's like, you're the only guy I'm not going to chase, because he was up against three Domo guys there.
Yep.
And he's just like, and when Carnarvon attacked, he's like, all right, looks like you're going to win today, Carnarvon. And he rolled away with it.
Well, those would have been like Van Petegem or Museo at the time too, wouldn't
they? Yeah, it was.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to pick your battles, don't you? You know, you've got to be willing to lose a race to win it sometimes, in those big ones especially. So you think that somebody's going to make that decision to chase him down, and if that doesn't happen, well, you have to be able to stand by the decision you've made.
All right, mate. Well, hit me with it.
Righto, let's go one more. Who have we got here? Again, I feel like I'm a bit repetitive with the way I've gone about this, but we'll go something different. We'll go Backstead. Maggie.
Very good.
So it's Cancellara who opens the sprint. Roger Hammer grits his teeth for this finest ever ride in this event. Backstead's got the inside lead now. Cancellara's got some speed. Hammer sprinting for the win on the left of the road. Magnus Backstead going with him here to the line. Backstead gets it. Third, second, it will be Tristan Hoffmann. Third, Roger Hammer.
Just thought he was a cool ride. Always, you know, watching the Tour de France stages, he was there for helping people. He had his time in the sun and, you know, pulled off the big W. And again, that was one where I'd just gone to Europe, you know, just started racing in Europe what was that? So it was 2004, was that correct?
I think 2004, yeah.
So 2004, you know, that's, I think, maybe second year juniors or whatever, and you just started over to Europe and start racing. And, you know, that was for me one of the first ones I watched after being to Europe, even as a junior or an under 19 or something. And, you know, I had not more of appreciation, but, you know, when you're young, it's a sport, you go to the nationals, but when you start going overseas racing, it's become more of a dream, I guess. He was the one that I really remember, you know, sitting and watching and going, I want to be racing these races. So that was one for me that, and, you know, again, you know, probably, well, it's obviously the best result of his career, but, you know, it's not like it's a Boonen who's won four times or, you know, Cancellara's won multiple times. It was one that was like, yeah, I'm happy to see this dude get a big W.
Yeah, I remember because he came into the velodrome. Roger Hammond, I think, was there, and Fabian, another CSC guy, was there, and they came in. Hoffman, was it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, mate, like, again, but if you look at those guys that finished there, Roger Hammond, he was always a guy that seemed to finish random up in that race. You know,
I know.
He's a polar opposite to all the other guys. You know, like, he's probably about 5 foot tall and, you know, like this little muscle ball. But, you know, he always seemed to be there, you know. But, you know, again, interesting finish. And that was with, what was it, Alessio Bianchi, I think, back in the day.
Oh, and Taffy was on the team as well, of course. One of Taffy's last sort of years. And on the track in the sprint, I remember when they were doing it, I just visually remember that Maggie came like underneath on the blue or even on the duckboards maybe. Like, it was a real funny sprint too, because like, it was a hard one. You got to think Fabian was riding for Fassa back then too.
Yeah, I do remember. I think you're right, actually. I can't remember the intricate details of it, but I do think I remember that dive down and pop back up. I don't know if you're thinking about, you know, what's going to get you rubbed on the track when you finish Roubaix either, but in the track,
nothing. Would anything get you rubbed?
I don't know.
Probably not.
I reckon you could take to the full-on flat inside, you know, the concrete. There's not a barrier there. I think it's pre-game. If you've fought over 250 Ks in the cobbles, shouldn't you just go for it? Imagine the thing with coming to the finish, you just hold him up on the fence, you know, go to the truck stand.
Yeah, because no rules apply. That's all the rules apply, man. Track rules apply. Because I think going back on the original edition, they wanted to do a few laps on the track to race on that first edition. Imagine trying to do like 10, 15 laps on the track, right? So that's one thing I'm always worried, I find funny, is that none of the other riders really sort of muck up the sprint of someone else. There's always, it sort of always works out. Riders coming in and riders finishing.
The other thing that I always find interesting too is obviously it's never going to happen. You've got a big bunch coming to the finish, but you've got people entering the track. You've got people doing their first lap. You know, you could have, I don't know what the rules would be. Like somebody could become entering the velodrome, what, say 30 seconds down for a lap down, and you're coming into the same group that's coming to the sprint. You know, like chuck a teammate in the way, get a little bit of a lead out from somebody you drop. Like, what's the go here?
Yeah. Yeah, you could definitely just wait on the fence.
But you're right, though. It's always been pretty fair sprint. You've never seen any sketchy stuff there. But I think that's also because everyone's knackered. You're like, I'm just going to go as fast as I can and hope that's enough. So Big Maggie's done started 8 editions. First edition's run 7th, which is still, you know, a pretty impressive.
Yeah, in his first edition.
Debut in that race. You know, you can probably talk about people's just first results in there, you know, because you know, that's a big effort. Finished lowest is 47th, which again, you know, that's not a bad day out, you know.
No.
Getting through the bad boy. And finished 5 of them. So, you know, for a guy, you know, he's probably got the build for it, 90-odd kgs, which, but again, we go back to what we were just saying, Roger Hammond probably weighed 65 kgs. It's a real technique type of race where you have to know how to ride the cobbles. But I definitely don't think that's the one race on the calendar that having a few extra kilos on you is going to be, you know, a big hindrance.
The thing I love about Maggie too is he really, like, I know he only rode it, we'll just say 8 times, not only, but 8 times, and like finished 5. So it's not like he's someone who's got this huge history with the race. He won it, of course, but like he's really embraced. He's one of the people who probably loves and talks about the race the most out of a lot of people. You hear him talking about his girls now racing about it. He really froths on the race. And it's amazing, you know, with a lot of guys, it just, well, look at me. I bloody love the race. And all I was doing was just floating around there in the bunch, you know. But it's just, it sort of just captures you, the race. And different people, it captures them in different ways. And like Magnus, he's like a real, he's a guy I connect to too, because he tells that story so well. And you're just like, yeah, I love Maggie's win. It feels like he should have won the race like 10 times, the amount he goes on about it.
Yeah.
All right, I've been saving him. I'm going to go straight into it. He's one of my favourite riders of all time, Taffy. Right,
Paul, and this cheer reserved for the champion of the day. It has to be the greatest arrival in world cycling because the crowd are just shouting his name and chanting his name, Taffy, Taffy, as he goes around the stadium. And he has all of the time in the world to enjoy what will be, without doubt, his finest hour. One lap to go, and they won't be in the stadium before he comes round again because they're still on that stretch of cobblestones outside the stadium. Andrea Taffy can wave to the crowd. He can seek out his wife Gloria and his son Tommaso, because now he is going to win at Paris-Roubaix. The memory when he was told he had to be third in 1996, and he got second last time, and now he is in the number one position. The sun high in the sky now after 6 hours and 40-odd minutes of cycling, but this man has been at the front for most of those hours too, and he's never looked really like he wasn't the man to beat. The two-handed salute for Andrea Taffy. He is going to enjoy every moment of this, winning as champion of Italy, as Francesco Moser did his hero in 1980.
Unbelievable. He's like, speaking about guys who absolutely love this race and put it up on a pedestal and just love it. Taffy has got to be up there. He's a guy I connected to aesthetically. I loved his style. Mappe, of course, cut cap. He absolutely loves this race. He wanted to emulate his cycling hero, Francesco Moser, to win the Roubaix in the national champs colour, which he was able to do in 1999. Before that, he'd already featured in three of the 1, 2, 3 Mappe finishes. Mappe finished first, second, third three times, and Taffy was in all three of those finishes. Yeah, Taffy was third on the first time. The second time he was second, and then he, in 1999, he wins it with his teammates, Peters second and Steele's third. He just absolutely loved this race. In his actual edition, 29K to go, he gets back after a puncher. I've just recently watched this because I had to go back and watch it. I just wanted to see it in full. So I watched the last like 100K. He gets a puncher. He's just riding. He's so far back up on the tops.
Yeah.
He gets back after the puncher, hits them on the normal road. Everyone's in his wheel. Wilfred Peters is in his wheel, his teammate. He just swings out, creates a gap, and the gap just opens up from there. They're all chasing behind. You've got Hincapie's in the group, Leon Van Bond, Joe Plankard. He's also in the group. Steels is in the group, Wilfred Peters. So they're blocking as well. Taffy just rides away, gets the cut cap, flings it off.
No.
So he's gone from, you know what, so no need for safety anymore. Get rid of this cap. I'm just going bare hair straight to the finish. He is so far back. He's got to be about 14 centimetres behind the bottom bracket. Unbelievable. He's practically in an aero position how far back he is.
Yeah.
Smashes along the cobbles. He gets to the velodrome. This is the best bit. Anyone's got to go back and watch this. As he gets to the velodrome, the crowd is literally chanting, Taffy, Taffy, Taffy. He just rolls around and like, this is one thing I missed a little bit from Vanderpoel on the weekend. Taffy just embraces the crowd. He doesn't bother pushing on. He just rolls in.
A little lap and a half. You come in, you get the bell. That's right, yeah?
But yeah, your lap and a half to go.
Take that in. That doesn't happen every day. You know, you want to be remembering that. You want to come in and you know every that last 450 metres or whatever those velodrome was. But, you know, soak it up, man. Soak it up.
He was just everything Roubaix. He started Roubaix 13 times. Of course, he finished 13 times. The lowest position he finished was 79th, and he won on his seventh attempt at the race. Taffy is a legend. I got a chance to ride with him. Did you ever ride with him? Like, not in a race, but, like, meet him in Italy?
I don't think I did, actually, man. I don't think I did. But, yeah, if you do, like you said, just one of those, there's so many stories. Just be, you know, you'd mention Roubaix and you'd be like, right, I've just opened a book. Let's, or, you know, like, what's it called? Like an audio book. You know, you just sit there, sit back and listen to it for the next hour. It'd be pretty amazing.
It was a couple of years ago. He was so fit and he was just rolling along on some rollers in Italy there. He had it in the big ring, of course, and he was just grinding up this climb. We did a little fake race over the top of this climb. He put me away. He just sprinted off in the 52, whatever it was, 16 or something. I was just like, he's still got it, this guy. It was my dream.
Like, you know, you talk about that position, but yeah, you know, he was the extreme of that position that you rode. But you know, that's what kind of what the technique you want to be using over the cobbles, isn't it? You want to be back over the back wheel, keep that front wheel light, so you're just puttering across the front of the cobbles. But to be able to do it in that position and generate the power is pretty amazing.
What about when he was age 52, 2018, he tried to come back and get a start in Roubaix? He actually had a team that was going to give him a start. I don't even know what team it was, but eventually he broke his collarbone, which put an end to that. Can you imagine him riding at age 52? I don't know if it would have wrecked it for him because it would have been a completely different era.
I think it'd be completely different, man. My bones would be shattered going across there at 52. but I do remember that. Was it the small Italian team? I can't remember what it was called at the time now, but like I do remember he come back, he got a spot, yeah, and he busted his collarbone. I do remember that. imagine having that mindset, you know, like, what are we? We're 38 this year. give us another 15 years and have a crack at his mate again. Mate.
I can't even imagine going back just being out of the peloton for a couple of years. I would just get killed out there, let alone at 52.
How fast they are. I'd be happy if I made it to the first sector. If you gave me a couple of minutes to train and get going, get committed, I'd be still pretty chuffed to make it to the first sector. Like, but even just a different equipment. Like, I remember 2010, I think it was, I decided to ride carbon wheels for the first time. And that was like, I remember some of the guys on the team looking at us like, you guys are idiots. What are you doing? Like full on aero race bike. It's just like no different. It's just, you know, imagine the shock for him from the last time he raced it. To jump on a bike, because that must have been around mid-two teens, like 2014, 2015, 2016, somewhere around there he was thinking about doing it.
2018, yeah.
2018, was it? There you go. So imagine going from the last time you did it, well, what would that have been like? maybe 2000.
2005 it was.
2005.
So another 13 years later.
Mate, like, you've got, like, so much has changed in the sport in that time. Like, I couldn't imagine.
Think about 13 years ago, what you were doing on the bike and how different it was.
Yeah, well.
We're on some, the Green Edge bike,
13
probably.
Years ago was San Remo. It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah. There you go.
Like, that's when we first had the Venge, you know, like, and that was, you know, the Specialized. We only had electronic gears for a couple, 1 year or something, I reckon. You know, now your disc brakes, bloody, everything's integrated. It's just a different, like, I got a new bike when I went to this ride to Everest with Stewie, and you hop on it, like, I just feel fast, even though I'm absolutely creeping, but you just feel fast. But imagine going back to that race, and the good thing was, would be that the roads are the same. They haven't changed in 120 years, so you know what you're in for there.
All right, well, who have you got, mate?
All right, I'm going to go back to an old teamie just because, again, my era, you know, pretty influential racing at that time is Fabian.
He can't believe it, but boy, does he deserve it. Fabian Cancellara wins Paris-Roubaix.
You know, it was always like this big, like that week in Flanders, Roubaix, Gent-Wevelgem, you know, E3, all those races. It was just like a clash of the titans of that era, you know, which was always cool. And even though you're in the race sometimes or you weren't in the race, but just watching them go at it was such an entertaining 4, 5, 6, 7 years of those guys going toe-to-toe, whether it be on the Quarmont, whether it be, you know, Aardenburg, Carrefour de l'Arve, some of these sectors. You always knew that you're going to see these two giants of that part of the sport absolutely tussling it out. And, you know, it was Fabian, we were talking about earlier, his first year he was a DNF, fourth the year after, started 12th, finished 11th. Again, lowest 49th. You know, it's pretty epic, isn't it?
What was it like being on the team with him? Were you on the team with him when you raced to Roubaix?
I raced with him in 2008. I was in the team that year where he finished second. That was my first Roubaix. 2007, I didn't. That was when Stewie won. And 2009, I can't remember if I did the race in 2009. I may have done, but I'm not sure.
Mate, that was your first edition.
2009.
32nd.
There you go. So I didn't race in 2008. I did 2009. So, yeah, I did 2 years with CSC that I didn't race it. And then, yeah, so I finished 32nd. He was 49th. There you go. Easy.
So what was it like being like, what was he like in the bus? Was he pretty stressful? Was he sharing the knowledge and stuff, or what was he like to race with?
Interesting, man. I actually roomed with him in 2009 when he wasn't really on form. I don't know what had happened previously, if something had happened that he wasn't really in contention, but interesting cat. Like I said, I roomed with him a bit, and, you know, he kind of had his own ways of motivating himself. And, you know, some of the times that was watching videos of his old races and things where he'd won or had success, and I was kind of like, that's a bit weird. But anyway, mate, whatever floats your boat, you're the one winning them, not me. So, but no, he was pretty handy. Like, he's just such a knowledgeable guy. You know, anyone that's raced it, you know, what, 12 times, they know the race like the back of their hand. And, you know, the first time you go out, you're right. And obviously the first day you do a recon, you know, you've got no idea of what you're doing. You just rely on the mechanics to put, you know, the right amount of pressure in your tire, and you get there and you're talking about 0.1 of a bar or 0.2 of a bar that these guys are talking about. And, you know, it's interesting, and just the equipment and, you know, different things they do for that day. So there's always knowledgeable, always, you know, was willing to help everyone. And, you know, in that 2009, I was actually going quite well. And, you know, he obviously knew that he wasn't in shape. So, not he wasn't in shape. He wasn't in the condition to win the race like he had been in the past. Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't as though he still was like, I'm out and out leader. I'm doing this. Everyone help me. You know, he was quite open. And, like, you know, if he was in a position to help out, he'd help out as well. And, yeah, so it was always good racing with him. You know, like his Flanders and those races that he had good results in were probably a year or two before I was in that actual team with him. But it's still cool to be, you know, in a race or in a team won those races. You know, it's just, you know, there's so much more. Once you're one of those guys, there's so much more attention, there's so much more pressure, there's so much more expectation around you. You know, you turn up to the start of Roubaix and the bus is surrounded by people just waiting for him to get out. you just see the way they handle that, and it's you know, something pretty cool to be part of, you know, even though it's not within the race yourself.
All right, I'm going to go with a bit of a different one, but I thought this was pretty influential for me. It was my last Roubaix, so 2021. It was a wet edition. The winner, Sonny Cobrelli.
On the line, it's Sonny Cobrelli, the first Italian victor since 1999.
Listen to these stats. First edition, first place. Started one, finished one. Lowest ever, first. That is nuts.
That's literally the case of just drops Mike, isn't it? Like, gets off the bike, stop, boom. obviously, you know, he was pretty unfortunate in his career a bit later on with, you know, his heart stuff, I think. But still, mate, if there's one race you could do that's one to be able to go, yeah, I did it once. How'd you go? Won it. Oh, right. Like, it's pretty insane, huh?
It was a really cool addition because, you know, that was my last one. I didn't really give a crap who'd won it that year because I was just like, I'm so done with this race. But looking back on it, it was such a really special edition of that Roubaix being later in the year, especially looking at those stats about maybe what he could have done in that race. If he's going to win in his first edition, yeah, could have gone on and won so many more. But like, just leaving it, like you said, the mic drop. It was actually 22 years since the last Italian winner from our favourite, Taffy.
Yeah, mate, that's it's pretty epic, isn't it? Like, to turn up to that race without having raced it before and to win. And with all due respect, it wasn't Boonen's first race, you know. Like, he's been racing in Belgium his whole life, racing the cobbles his whole life, you know, and wasn't probably one of the biggest favourites there, you know, to go away with. That's epic, you know.
In a wet, ridiculous, wet, slippery edition. It wasn't even just like a normal edition.
He probably wasn't sitting on a start line going, I reckon I've got these fellas in the bag today.
You know, he might have been. Maybe. I don't know him personally. Maybe he's just super confident. I don't know.
But, mate, that was one thing I always wanted to do, and I don't know why. I think it's just nuts to think about.
Win Roubaix on your first one. Yeah. I wouldn't have minded either.
I didn't work any of them, but but to do a wet one, a wet Roubaix.
Yeah.
I never did it. We had sections that were wet and stuff, but, you know, I think it brings a whole new element to that race. Don't get me wrong. It's a technical race, you know, you're on cobblestones, whatever, but to do it in the wet, that brings a whole new element of bike handling and positioning and non-stop concentration for 6 hours. That would have been pretty cool to do one. And I think I hit this dry spell in the north of France for about 10 years where it didn't rain at all, so I never actually did one of the conditions that I did.
All right, mate, how many we got left? Is this your last one? Run me through your top five. Who have you done so far?
Boone, Heyman, Taffy, Stewie, Magnus, and Fabian.
Are you done?
Done. So, yeah, Boonen.
Who's your sixth then?
Sorry, yeah. So I had Taffy with you. Sorry, mate. I should have picked that one up. Just because of those Mapei days, you know, like just seeing that team dominate and, you know, coming to the velodrome with three dudes. And like we've said, this race is so difficult just to get your team leader or get yourself to the finish line. Doing that with three, man, that's just a different kettle of fish, isn't it? Like, I think Taffy was more so just for the Mapei team in that era where they just dominated. And, you know, those pictures that when you're a kid, seeing three guys finishing 1, 2, 3 in Roubaix.
This is a complete lap of honour. 1, 2, and 3 by the Mapei team. I've never seen anything like this before in this race or in a classic of this stature before. The 100th anniversary of the Paris-Roubaix will be celebrated all the way throughout Italy and throughout Belgium. 1, 2, and 3. Mapei triumph with Museo first across the line. Bortolami alongside him, Taffy into third spot. That was a dominant piece of bike racing, the like of which I've not seen before.
All right, I'm going to throw my sixth one out now. This is my sort of questionable, and it's a bit of a different one, but you've already sort of set it up. I might as well hit it out of the park. Team Mapei is my roughie, and for numerous reasons. For the reason you just said, we just got to look at the results here. 95, they come in. They're first and third with Ballerini and Museo. The following year, they get 96, they do the 1, 2, 3, Museo, Bortolomi, Taffy. And in the Italian newspapers, the headline is, this is what we do underneath the photo. But doing a bit of research into it is like there's many stories about how that all came. Have a look at the photo of it. The three of them come onto the velodrome. Who decide who won that day? Apparently the story goes that about 85K to go, the three of them go off the front. Actually, the four of them go off the front. Ballerini gets a puncher, so there's three of them left. Giorgio Squinzi, he calls up Lefebvre, who's actually the sports director at the time. And apparently Lefebvre just hears, I want them all three to go to the velodrome. And then the phone cuts out. So Lefebvre just makes his own decision at the end. Okay, of course the Belgi wins, Museo. And the two Italians can come second and third. Yeah. So they were super pissed after that. Squinzi apparently wanted them all to fight it out on the velodrome, get them all there and then let them fight it out in the velodrome. After that, Museo finishes third the next year. They go 1-2-3 in 98, Ballerini, Taffy, Wilfred Peters. And then 99, they go 1-2-3 again, Taffy, Peters, Steels. 2000, Museo wins. 2001, Ballerini, he retires. Remember this scene, retires by unzipping his jersey and revealing Mercy Roubaix. So, like, it's just everything about that race was Mappe. If they weren't winning it, they were just featuring in the race. They just controlled that race. For me, whenever I think of Roubaix, I think of Mappe, I think of the Colnago, the blocks, everything about those two things are just perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's like you said, the bikes. It's one of those bikes that I remember wanting to have one of my bikes painted like them, because you want to be like those dudes, you know? And just that dominance is something that, you know, you have to admire. You have to look at it and go, wow, that's just so difficult to achieve. But when you can see him doing it and doing it, you know, multiple years, it's pretty epic. Pretty epic.
All right, Gossie, let's finish it up, mate. What is your number six, your questionable, most influential part of Roubaix?
But I think it is actually a sector or sectors of the race, which, you know, I think everyone, there's always a famous sections. You know, you look at the Tour de France, Alpe d'Huez, you know, but there's definitely harder stuff in there. And I actually think that's the same in Roubaix. You know, you've got Aremberg, don't get me wrong, it's massive, it's huge, the crowds are there. But I think that there's actually harder sections in the race. And one of the ones is Carrefour de l'Arbre. You know, I think that sector towards the end of the race, it's a bit longer. You're a lot more tired. Mm. It's probably just as brutal, if not more. You know, twists and turns in there. So I'm not saying that it's questionable in terms of Arenberg's overrated. Don't get me wrong. Everyone knows that that's not the case. But, you know, I think it's funny that these races get one thing that you think about of that race when, you know, there's other sectors in there that, you know, make your bones shiver or make your body shiver before you get there, because you're like, this is going to be brutal. And it's just hold on. And
well, I think that's a really good point, because we always say Arenberg's not where you win the race, but it's where you lose it. Arguably, Carrefour de l'Arbre is where you win the race.
It is. There's a few sectors left after that, but it's probably one of the hardest sectors in the last 30, 40K. And that's generally where, you know, the race is already split apart, but that's where the race winning moves are happening. That sector, people aren't doing it on the last one into the velodrome. That's just a little bit of, you know, that's not a cobble compared to the other stuff. That's one of the last points where if you're going to make the race hard, you're going to make the race interesting, that's the section you want to do it on. Yeah, so I just think that one's an interesting one, mate. I think it's questionable, you know, in terms of it probably doesn't get the recognition it deserves. You know, it was different for us, I guess. We've rode the race and you've been over them all. But, you know, if you went to one of those cycle tours and you got to Carrefour de l'Arbre and you thought, oh, at least I've done Arenberg, everything else is going to be all right, I reckon you get a pretty rude shot.
Mate, that was a very good point. And always great talking Roubaix. Look, we could have gone on for ages. We should have made top 50 most influential. Maybe we can do another part later on. Gossie, awesome to have you on the pod, mate. We're going to get you back later on.
It's awesome. Always having a chat, man. And, you know, hopefully the rest of the races this season is fun to watch.
Well, there we go. What'd you think? Send it in. Do you agree? Do you not agree? Who have I missed? Franco Ballerini. How did he not make it? There was too many to sort of go over. Big thanks goes out to our major partner, MAP. Of course, Red Bricks Media, who put these episodes together, the Life in the Peloton team, and all those guys over at the Pelo. I am loving chatting to you guys in our little chat group. This has been fun. If you're not a member, get across to lifeinthepeloton.com, get across to the Pelo, and sign up to the Echelon if you want to get in on this group, get in on the extra podcast, and also get a limited edition Life in the Peloton book that is coming to you very, very soon. That's really exciting stuff. Guys, I've got a really exciting episode coming for you next week called What is Enduro? I'll leave it there, and until next week, cheers.
That iconic music in this episode was composed by none other than the legend, Pete Shelley. Cheers, mate.